From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. They were so close. Lawmakers on Capitol Hill looked like they were ready to sign on to a $700 billion bailout of the financial markets. Then, well, politics got involved, including presidential politics. Add on to that a bank failure and a threatened but revived presidential debate, and we've got plenty for the folks on our reporters' roundtable to talk about. With us, Clarence Page, a columnist for the Chicago Tribune, and Marcus Mabry, the international business editor for the New York Times. Hi, guys.
Hi, how are you?
Is there enough going on for us to talk about? I mean,
so boring, isn't it?
It is. You know, you have those slow news weeks. Anyway, let's start with these negotiations over the financial bailout package. The talks broke down. They're back on. At the time of this show, no deal has been announced. Clarence, you're in D.C. What do you think made the talks break down?
Certainly when Senator Shelby from Alabama from the Senate Finance Committee came out and said that they don't have a deal, that was an indication that they didn't. Other than that, even before that happened, there was talk about arguing and even shouting in the room. The big summit that President Bush pulled together of Republicans and Democrats. There are some key philosophical differences here as to what kind of regulation is needed now to prevent this kind of failure again. But even before that, there's the question about the package itself, whether the $700 billion is realistic, how it should be doled out. It's probably not going to be doled out all at once. Senator Chuck Schumer's idea of doling out, I believe, $250 million initially is probably closer to what's going to happen with the final agreement. There will be a final agreement of some kind. Exactly when it's going to happen and what form it will take, we don't know.
Marcus, I'm hearing all sorts of things from people on the street and as well as people in the media. This is a good deal just for the banks. It's not good for the people. This is good for the people and good for the banks. It's neither good for the banks nor good for the people. Where is the crux of the decision-making leading us in terms of responsibility for financial decisions already made and also the court of public opinion?
Well, it's interesting. I think those things may be diverging and not for the good, actually. I think there's no question. It is a good deal for the banks. It's their responsibility. We could see more banks going under, as we just saw Washington Mutual go under just overnight. We could see more bank failures. That was the largest bank failure by a factor of 10, $300 billion we've ever seen in this country. But what that points out to us is that it's not a question of the bank's interest versus the public interest at this point. Our interests are that these banks survive. These are the banks that give loans to us. Right now we have a credit market. Don't look at the stock market. Look at the credit market. That's where we actually have banks lending to each other and to companies and to consumers. No one is lending money to anyone right now. Our economy is basically frozen when it comes to the credit markets. And that's the stuff that lubricates our economy. Right now everyone is waiting for there to be a deal. I think, you know, from a political point of view, I think it doesn't look very good for Senator McCain right now because he raced down there and he said he was, you know, going to be there. And as he said, as we quote in the front page of the Times today, he had said, you know, I'll let you be the judge of how much of I have to do with a deal that comes about. Well, as Barney Frank, the chairman of the House Finance Committee, said, they had the basic outlines of a deal. Chris Dodd, a Republican senator from Connecticut, said that serious Republicans had a deal. And then John McCain got down there, and the House Republicans were revolting, as Groucho Marx might say, and there was no deal. Right now, we have the House Republicans and Senator McCain who are revolting, and Senator McCain not even stating clearly what he thinks should be the deal. It's an incredible political brinksmanship that's backfired and may eventually backfire right into the homes and the offices and the workplaces of Americans.
Clarence, what about presidential politics in this? You had this very unprecedented situation of the major party candidates sitting down with the president, no one particularly happy, but there is a very unusual role that the presidential candidates have played in this whole negotiation, considering particularly that neither of them were involved with the committees that really dealt with this kind of financial issue.
That's right.
What's going on here?
Well, What has happened is that the candidates, led by John McCain, as you just heard, have nationalized this this debate, or I should say, they've put the presidential race right in the center of this debate, which has actually helped abolish up the works, and it's put McCain on the spot now, where he's inserted himself into the middle, but then not taken much of an active role, and I think. Marcus is right that it has backfired. At the same time, Senator Obama has not been terribly outspoken, been more cautious, which tends to be his style, and he'll probably come out the winner in the end as a result of that, because at least nobody can blame him for having made things more difficult. So McCain has now agreed to debate, so we'll wait and see how it looks afterwards. But I think that the general sense is that debate itself is going to wipe out memories of the role that McCain and Obama played in these initial negotiations.
Marcus, this is supposed to be a foreign policy debate, and yet the discussion this week has very much been about domestic economics. So how do you think that's going to play out as the candidates try to debate?
Already we've had the moderator, Jim Lehrer, come out and say he will ask questions about the economy right off the bat. He will talk about this financial crisis that that we and therefore the world is facing right now, and then he will talk about foreign policy as well. But they are not going to try to avoid the elephant in the room, which is the economic situation. In many ways, I think it's very illustrative of this entire presidential campaign. Remember, this is foreign policy was supposed to be a big issue. Iraq was supposed to be a big issue. Well, as it turns out, we're in the midst of an economic downturn, the depth of which we don't really know yet. Usually you understand these things after the fact. And so it's actually being foreign policy has been displaced in the campaign and is going to be displaced to some extent tonight by economic issues. They will certainly talk about foreign policy. They have 90 minutes. That's plenty of time to talk about foreign policy. And I think there we'll see very stark contrast in views. I think Obama will talk a lot more about the importance of diplomacy and reestablishing America's position in the world, both from a hard power point of view, meaning militarily, but also from a soft power point of view, meaning when it comes to things like suasion and things like economic and cultural and social viability, where I think McCain's going to talk a lot more about strength, military strength, determination, experience, all things that play to his strong suit. It's going to be interesting to see how it plays out because, again, everyone's going to be thinking about their bank account, the solvency of their own bank, the stability of their own finances, while we're watching them talk about the world and world affairs.
Before I get to you, Clarence, because I'm going to ask you the same thing, with all that's been going on in and around Pakistan, how does that impact what's going on in the U.S. domestically? What's the point of intersection? Marcus.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought this was for Clarence. This is a tough one. I mean, in a way, and as someone who cares deeply about foreign policy, I can't wait to see how they answer these questions because this has been a horrible week for the markets and for all of us who are concerned about financial stability. But it's also been a horrible week for American foreign policy. The few accomplishments, and I think any objective person would have to say there are only a few accomplishments that the Bush administration has made in its 7.5 years in power when it comes to foreign policy, are unraveling. A deal with North Korea, one of the few successes, a deal with North Korea to get them to dismantle their nuclear program, well, that's unraveled. The North Koreans saying we're going to go back in and reestablish after destroying part of our reactors, we're going to go back in and reestablish a nuclear program. So you have a nuclear Iran on the horizon as well as a nuclear North Korea. Pakistan, of course, is now firing on American troops who crossed the border. Pakistan was the Bush administration's greatest ally in the region in the war on terror, other than Iraq, of course, where we invaded and helped establish the government that is currently ruling that country. So it's extraordinary.
Clarence, how do you think these foreign policy issues are going to affect our ability as a nation to deal with the economic issues and the other political issues domestically?
Well, in the short term, the Americans are saying make the world go away. They're not paying attention to those other issues. They're simply being overshadowed at a time when the collapse of WaMu, the biggest bank collapse in history, is kind of relegated to below the fold in newspaper terms. It's hard to get much attention to Pakistan, even though we should. There's a dangerous pattern developing when you see Russia's moves in Georgia, when you see Pakistan troops firing at our troops across the border, and the weaknesses that we know about of Pakistan's existing central government. These are very dangerous times that certainly are going to be very significant for whoever the next president is going to be, and may even emerge as an issue yet before November. But I tend to doubt it. I think right now the economy is really going to hold center stage for a while.
All right. I'm going to ask more about this when we come back from a break. We have a tiny bit of time before a break. But Marcus, do you think that Sarah Palin's interview has made a difference in people's opinion of her or of her ticket?
Well, the question is, I don't know how many people have seen her interview, and particularly the interview with Katie Couric twice on CBS in two different pieces. And she had a Charlie Gibson ABC interview before that. Right now, certainly the media critics' point of view is that she's not been impressive. There's certainly some reason to believe from opinion polls that the bloom is off the rose, that her popularity is not what it was when she was originally introduced. I think really the But when the Americans will really focus in on her will be at the vice presidential debates next week. That will really be her opportunity. And if she has better answers than she has so far, then I think everything else would be forgiven. But she has to get better answers than she's given so far.
This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. We have more of our Reporters Roundtable with Marcus Mabry, the international business editor for the New York Times, and Clarence Page, a columnist for the Chicago Tribune. So before we took a little break, we were talking a little bit about this interview that Sarah Palin gave, a follow-up interview with Katie Couric. And the word mocked came up about what people had thought of her before. And now she's still being mocked, particularly for a comment that had to do with the proximity of Alaska to Russia and flight patterns of planes. Clarence, do you think that she is being overly criticized, or is this fair game?
Well, she did complain of being mocked by the media, but Katie Couric asked her several follow-up questions in regard to Alaska's relations to Russia, and she made the mistake, in my view, of trying to inflate the role of Alaska in our relations with Russia, talking about trade policy and how critical the trade relationship was between Alaska and Russia. It turned out that Russia ranked way down as far as trading partners went with Alaska, and when she was directly asked what role she had played in relations with Russia, she really didn't have an answer. So it really kind of dug the hole deeper for her, insofar as the jokes that have been made about being able to see Russia from her house. Marcus is right. Everybody's waiting for the debates to see with her against Joe Biden, who also has a reputation for sticking foot in mouth, which he enhanced this past week. Everybody's mm-hmm. waiting to see who will make the most gaffes during that debate.
Yeah, Marcus, I heard it. Mm-hmm.
Well, talk about, the goal in before these debates is always to talk down expectations so that everyone has a low expectation of your candidate. So they think your candidate, if they even do a mediocre job, it looks good because you've deflated expectations so much. Well, that should not be a problem with next week at this point. I think expectations are low for both of those candidates.
All right. Well, Marcus, I know that you were a correspondent for Newsweek in South Africa, and I want to move on to another nation which is having big political news. The South African president, Thabo Mbeki, stepped down this week under party pressure. A former anti-apartheid leader, Kgalema Motlanthe, has become the country's new president. What can you say about him?
It's interesting. He's incredibly popular in the ruling African National Congress, the ANC, which, of course, was the party that battled apartheid for decades, and the party of Nelson Mandela. And Nelson Mandela, of course, the senior statesman of all Africa, who's been ailing, of course, who's incredibly advanced in age now. I think South Africa is missing him greatly. Certainly international investors are not taking the kind of change in leadership well in South Africa. This new president is just a caretaker. He's just a president until Jacob Zuma, who's the head of the ANC and who will almost certainly, and almost certainly minus some calamity we cannot foresee, will become the president of South Africa. Many international investors are worried about him. South Africa depends to a great extent on foreign capital coming into the country and developing it. It is still trying to overcome the legacies of apartheid. And so they're going to have to do a lot to reassure investors. To some extent, the new president helps because he's going to keep on people like Trevor Manuel, the finance minister, who's greatly respected. But there's going to be a real kind of transition here in South Africa, and the country's going to have to reassure foreign markets, especially at a time in which foreign markets are a very jittery period, given the American financial crisis.
Clarence, we just talked a bit about how the U.S. is kind of, you know, circling the wagons because we feel threatened. But South Africa is, as Marcus mentioned, this huge economic engine, not just in and of itself, but for the entire region. So right. If there's some, you know, political wibble wobbles there, do you think that that could throw off other Southern African or African nations?
Oh, no question about it. South Africa is the economic engine. I've been there several times over the last 25 years since the apartheid days, and this is an intriguing period. Jacob Zuma is a man who's very popular. He comes out of the labor movement over there, which is important. I think we might see more pressure on people like Robert Mugabe with Zuma moving up. These are the kind of changes the world is looking at, because South Africa is the central economic power for the region. It is also a very, very important strategic and diplomatic power. There are a lot of reasons why Jacob Zuma could be the key person to help to move the continent further toward the new Africa leadership we've talked about, away from the old big man style of people like Robert Mugabe.
Marcus, to wrap this up, what do you see ahead for South Africa in the next, say, 10 years? I mean, and what I mean by that's a big question, but let me say very specifically, do you think South Africa will play an activist role in regional governments like Zimbabwe? It's kind of gone back and forth on that. What do you think will happen with South Africa, not just as an economic engine, but as a political engine?
Well, you know, it can't help but be a strong player in the region, and therefore in the world. Even despite these problems we're having economically in our country right now, it is a small, increasingly smaller, interconnected, globalized world. South Africa, as the leader on the continent, and they're kind of, you know, two poles in sub-Saharan Africa, one being Nigeria, one being South Africa, those two countries have great importance both economically and politically. South Africa will continue to be a main mover on the continent politically. It's just a question of how they want to move it. There's no question they will continue to be a regional powerhouse.
Well, gentlemen, there's always plenty to talk about with you guys, and it's great to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We were speaking with Clarence Page, a columnist for the Chicago Tribune. He joined us from our NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C., and Marcus Mabry, the international business editor for the New York Times. He joined us from our NPR studios in New York City. Georgia inmate Troy Davis was scheduled to be executed on Tuesday, but hours before he was supposed to die by lethal injection, the U.S. Supreme Court granted him a last-minute stay of execution. He was convicted of killing an off-duty police officer in Savannah, Georgia. He's been on death row for 17 years. The case was based solely on eyewitness testimony. 7 of the 9 eyewitnesses have since recanted their testimony, and human rights activists are calling for a new trial. In a few minutes, we'll talk to one of those activists. But joining us now from Atlanta is NPR's Kathy Lohr. She's been covering the case. Kathy, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm great. This is a really, really fascinating case. It's not often that the U.S. Supreme Court gets involved in cases like this. What makes this different?
It is interesting. It dates back to 1989 when an off-duty Savannah police officer, whose name is Mark McPhail, was killed. The shooting took place in a parking lot of a fast food restaurant near a bus station where the officer was working as a security guard. And it was even a high-profile case at the time, as you can imagine, because it was involving the murder of a police officer. Now, Troy Davis has always claimed that he was innocent, but at trial, there were 9 witnesses who testified that Davis was the shooter. So the murder weapon in this case was never found. There was no evidence other than eyewitness testimony, as you've said. And there is some evidence that police coerced at least some of the witnesses to identify Davis as the shooter at the time. But since the trial, 7 of those witnesses recanted or changed their testimony, and other witnesses have come forward to identify another suspect. So now the Supreme Court has issued a stay, at least a temporary stay, taking a look at this case.
What do we know about the cases where the witnesses did not change or recant their testimony?
What do we know about the cases where they did not change their testimony?
What makes them different from the others who did change their testimony?
Well, one of the witnesses who did not change his testimony is someone who is identified as a suspect in the case, and actually people have come forward now and pointed to this man. The other person who did not recant was apparently in a car, from what I'm understanding, and really didn't have that great of a view of the scene. The other 7 have come forward to change their stories.
So what happens now?
The U.S. Supreme Court, that is, granted a temporary stay on Tuesday, and the court is scheduled to discuss this case next week on Monday. But this is the court's first meeting since the term ended, so there is a backlog of cases, and at this point we're not sure when the court would decide or when the court might announce its decision. The Supreme Court gets about 8,000 petitions a year, and many of those are death penalty cases. It hears only 100 of them. So in that sense, it might be a long shot. But as we said, this is an interesting case. It's received a lot of attention nationwide. What we don't know is whether the 7 witnesses recanting is enough, whether that rises to the standard where the Supreme Court would take this case.
And you've reached out to the Georgia Attorney General's office. So what has their response been?
Well, actually, it goes back to it's right now it's the Georgia Board of Pardons and Paroles was the sort of the last avenue here in Georgia. And they denied clemency under sort of lots of pressure. Thousands of letters were written on behalf of Troy Davis beginning last summer and going on until just this week, including folks like Pope Benedict and the South Africa Archbishop Desmond Tutu, former President Jimmy Carter, civil rights activists. But even advocates for the death penalty, including former FBI Director William Sessions and former federal prosecutor Bob Barr, who also happens to be the Libertarian candidate for president, they've also said that the case needs to be reexamined, that there are still too many unanswered questions. However, the Georgia board did not apparently decide that way. They did issue a statement, which is unusual in and of itself, saying that basically they considered this case for a very long time. They heard from witnesses. They questioned the witnesses. And that basically clemency was not warranted. So that's how it ended up before the U.S. Supreme Court, if in fact the court decides to take that case.
Well, Kathy, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
That was Kathy Lohr. She's an NPR correspondent in Atlanta and joined us from her studio there. Amnesty International has taken on Troy Davis's case, and joining us now, we've got Jared Foyer. He's the Southern Regional Director for Amnesty International. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine.
So how did this case come to your attention?
Well, Amnesty International is an abolitionist organization, so we do oppose the death penalty. In all cases, we consider it the ultimate human rights violation, and so we oppose it out of moral reasons. That said, Troy Davis as one of the many cases that we've chosen to hold up really comes from the fact that we believe his case points to all that is wrong with the death penalty. You have issues of racial bias. You have issues of witness mishandling. You have procedural obstacles that ultimately end up being more important than basic questions of guilt and innocence. And then at the end of the day, you have a system that's really not going back and addressing its mistakes, putting way too much weight on that initial trial when there was inadequate legal counsel.
So why do you think the witnesses are changing their stories?
Well, these were witnesses who at the time were, in some cases, they were 16 years old. One of them was on parole. They were in very vulnerable positions. And you had a climate in Savannah that was very charged. You had a police officer that was shot. You had tremendous pressure on the district attorney to get a conviction. And so you thus had tremendous pressure on the witnesses. And the witnesses in their recantation stated the pressure that they were put under. They were intimidated. They were told they better do this. During the Georgia Parole Board hearing, one witness spoke about how a gun was put on the table in front of them. And so what was created was a climate of fear where they were afraid to basically tell what they believed to be the truth. And over the years, they have come forward at risk to themselves. They're not doing this for any reason, including being subpoenaed. But they're doing it because they believe that the truth does need to come out. The problem is that the courts have been unwilling to go back and look at these foundational questions of guilt and innocence and consider the recanted testimony. And when the appeals courts have heard the case, what they have not looked at is the value of the evidence on those questions of innocence. They've looked at whether the evidence can compel a new trial on procedural grounds.
So, again, not based on evidence, but based on procedure. What do you think that bodes for this case, for Troy Davis?
Well, on procedure, it's interesting because the Georgia Supreme Court was the most recent court that looked at this case, and they looked at it in March. And it's that decision that's actually been appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. And when they looked at it, they were looking under grounds of cases where there had been one recantation, not seven recantations. And so the threshold is entirely different in this case. In addition, the Georgia decision, if you read it, they were looking at all sorts of reasons to discount the testimony, such as it wasn't properly notarized, or the defense did not properly show Troy Davis's dominant hand. And so I believe that there is substantial evidence to go to the Supreme Court and for the Supreme Court to be looking at this under an Eighth Amendment claim to basically say, and this is the issue at hand, and it's interesting, is whether or not it is an Eighth Amendment violation, whether or not it is unconstitutional to execute someone who is potentially innocent.
How has Troy been dealing with this? Because this is his second stay of execution. He got another stay last July. Do you have any idea how he as a man is dealing with this?
Right. This is not only his second stay, but this is his second stay within 24 hours. This time, the stay came at 5:30 p.m. when the execution was set for 7 o'clock. And they were even leading the witnesses to the witnesses for his execution into the room where they were going to oversee the execution. But, you know, Troy and his family are some of the most solid people that I've ever met. They come from places of deep faith, and they're really able to sort of hold tight while everyone else around them, including myself and my colleagues at Amnesty, have, you know, been getting a little bit emotional. But even for us, you know, at the end of the day, this case is about Troy. It's also about the foundational issues of the death penalty and whether or not we're going to continue to proceed with a system that has all the problems that we see in Troy Davis's case.
Just quickly, where do you plan to go with this case, very briefly?
Well, it's at the U.S. Supreme Court's hands. They will decide either this Monday or probably the subsequent Monday whether or not they're going to hear the case. If they hear it, it will be in October, and you'll have a spring decision. Underlying all of this is the fact that the Georgia Board can grant a clemency at any time. And so our hope is that regardless of what the Supreme Court does, the Georgia Board, which is the fail-safe in Georgia, will look at it and say, you know what, we don't feel comfortable with an execution going forward with all these questions.
Well, Jared, thanks so much.
Thank you for covering this story.
We're speaking with Jared Foyer, the Southern Regional Director of Amnesty International, and he joined us from the studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. Chris Rock goes on late night TV. We heard a little bit of him and gives Bill Clinton a bit of his mind. Actress Jada Pinkett Smith becomes a bigger force in Hollywood. We've got Newsweek magazine's Allison Samuels always ready with the latest entertainment news. We can't even keep Chris in a box. How you doing, Allison?
I'm fine. How you doing?
Great. So Chris has a new HBO special. He was on the Letterman show just the other day, sat down in a seat that had been warmed by the buns of none other than Bill Clinton. Here's a bit of what Rock said about Clinton.
Is that me or he didn't want to say the name Barack Obama? Like, he did not. He went through everything he could do. Well, like Hillary would want to do it to their kind. Hillary ain't running.
Well, Clinton was on The Daily Show the next night, and it seemed like he couldn't say Barack Obama often enough. He had become a changed man. Do you think Chris Rock did it?
Oh, yeah. I think that, you know, when you looked at, I mean, he had to sort of look at that clip, and he and Chris are friends because Chris has said that they're friends. I'm sure he took some lessons from that because it's like, you know, if he's trying to get the black community, the African-American community back on his side, you know, doing interviews like the one he did with Letterman isn't going to help because it was so clear that he doesn't necessarily like Obama. And I just think that is something that, you know, being a team player, you have to play it off. And on Letterman, I mean, Chris was on Larry King last night. He toned it down a little bit, but he didn't, you know, make the same point that, you know, he needs to give him a little bit more support. He's only giving him limited support. So Chris is sort of funny, but he's making his point at the same time.
What do we know about this big special of his, Chris Rock's?
He's talking a lot about politics, obviously. And it's funny because, you know, he says, you know, people think you can't make fun of Obama. But he says, yeah, I can make fun of Obama, which is funny. Because it's nothing. On the surface, you don't really see anything that funny about Obama. Whereas John McCain, like he said, all you have to do is pull out your Reagan jokes and you can go after John McCain. But with Obama, it's like this new challenge of what's funny about him. So I think it should be pretty funny.
All right. We've got another person who's a big name, Jada Pinkett Smith. Not everyone has seen a lot of her recently, but she's been more behind the camera, but she's coming onto the small screen for TNT. What's she doing?
She's doing a special, and it's somewhat in the vein of The Closer and Grace Under Fire, where she's this hospital nurse that nurtures people, has a child, and is basically this woman, superwoman, who does it all. And I think it's great because I sort of wondered when I watched The Closer and Grace Under Fire, I'm like, okay, now where's the black woman who can do it all and is tough? And you know, we have plenty of those. So I'm glad that she's taking that under her wing. And then also, you know, she's been producing, she produced Secret Life of Bees, which I think is really, she did that along with Will, which I think is great because that's one thing that I think has been a big problem in Hollywood, making roles available for African-American women in particular. In Lakeview Terrace, which she also produced with Will, you know, Kerry Washington is in there, and her husband is a white man. So they're trying to sort of shake things up and do things, you know, to sort of give African-Americans a chance behind the screen and in front of the camera.
You also have been keeping track of another show that's gotten some heat, True Blood, an right. HBO vampire drama set in the modern-day South. It just got picked up for a second season. Right. So tell me just a little bit about the creator of the series and the main characters.
Well, Alan Ball, who did 6 Feet Under, also created this series. And it's, you know, about vampires who are actually living among us in the real world. But the problem that I have with it, and I love vampire movies, love Buffy the Vampire Slayer, but, you know, the African-American characters are so stereotypical. The girl on there who's a cute, you know, African-American girl, but, you know, the sassy, loudmouth, neck-rolling person that you always have. The black male on there is a transgender, lipstick-wearing drug dealer. And I'm like, even in vampire world, African-Americans have to be stereotypical, even in fantasy land? So that's my issue with it. Even though I love vampire movies, yeah.
Okay, so Tara is the one who's she was described as poison-tongued, eye-rolling, gum-snapping by one of our bloggers, Patrice Yersic. And we've got a clip here of the Tara character played by Rutina Wesley. Let's listen.
I have a name, and that name is Tara. And isn't that funny, a black girl being named after a plantation? No, I don't think it's funny at all. In fact, it really pisses me off that my mama was either stupid or just plain mean. Which is why you better be nice if you plan on getting a drink tonight.
And yet, it sounds like you like the show on some level.
I mean, well, like I said, I do like, you know, vampire shows. And it's funny on, you know, in some parts, but she wears me out. Even though I like the actress, but I just, you know, it's just so over the top, her performance. And like I said, the black man is a transgender, lipstick-wearing drug dealer. I'm like, it's too much. I can't handle this. So I like it, but I don't know how much I'm going to. If he doesn't sort of develop those characters a little further, yeah, I don't know how much I'll be watching it.
Okay, Alan Ball, you're going to get a note in the mail. Allison, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was our entertainment news guru, Newsweek Magazine's national correspondent, Allison Samuels, and she joined me in our studios here at NPR West. It's September 1944. World War II is in full flourish. The all-black 92nd Buffalo Soldier Division is trapped behind enemy lines in Nazi-occupied Italy. They've survived a bloody battle made worse by a white commander who doesn't believe in his own men. While battling the racism and the Nazi attacks, one of the men risks his life to save a young Italian boy.
I'm Staff Sergeant Aubrey Stamps. We got a boy that needs help.
Un bimbo. Un bimbo.
I have to tell them we're taking the boy to a hospital. They can come too. They need to evacuate anyway. We'll escort them down the mountain.
Miracle at St. Anna is filmmaker Spike Lee's first war movie. It's based on James McBride's novel of the same name, and the best-selling writer McBride also wrote the screenplay. On Monday, you can tune in for our conversation with director Spike Lee. But right now, we want you to listen in on a conversation I had with three stars of the film, Derek Luke, Laz Alonso, and Omar Benson Miller. They were all with me at our studios at NPR West, and we had writer James McBride on the line as well. I started off by asking Laz Alonso about playing an older veteran in the opening scene.
Well, for me, it started off, you know, with knowing that these characters were actually real living souls. They were real people who experienced this at one time. James McBride actually used to be best friends with and rode the train with every day with the character who I portray was based on. You know, so to know that these same exact words weren't something that came out of someone's figment of their imagination, but they were direct quotes from James's interviews with these veterans, it really put the level of responsibility on portraying these characters into a whole different place for me.
Well, James, Laz has already pointed out that you have a personal connection to the material, hearing the stories of a generation of men who's dying out now. Mm. What really prompted you to make this happen?
Well, I had an uncle who served in World War II, and when I was a kid, I used to hear him talk about, you know, the Italians loved the colored man and so forth. And I never paid attention to those stories until I became grown and became a writer, and long after he passed. And then when I started researching Miracle at St. Anna, I interviewed at least two or three dozen veterans from the 92nd Division, and then I moved to Italy for 6 months or so and interviewed Italians and people from that side of the war.
Derek, tell me about your character and his relationship to power and how it changes over the time that he is there in Italy.
My character is Staff Sergeant Aubrey Stamps, and I'm part of the four that gets separated from our regiment, and I think part of the power, to answer your question, is having a scope or a vision for the future. I think that Stamps felt like, you know, we couldn't continue like this, the way the country was and the political climate, the racial climate, that it couldn't continue. In the film and during the 1944, my character, he was one of the few that was not drafted but enlisted and had a college degree. So education played a whole lot on his plate.
Uh-oh, there's a pound going on, a terrorist fist jab.
Oh, terrorist, dang.
I might have to call Homeland Security right now. Hello, this interview is over. I just saw DAP. I just saw DAP in the office. I wanted to let you know. Moving on to you, Omar. Your character is, and this is, of course, incredibly pivotal to the whole story, is takes responsibility for a young boy, a young Italian boy, who he can't even speak the same language with. What was it like playing someone who had that kind of a heart?
For me, playing Train was angelic in a way. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, you can ask the fellas. There was a lot of activities that I'm involved in my day-to-day life that I wasn't involved in when we were shooting the film. Based on my dedication to try to keep the innocence about this man who's almost like a man-child, because he's actually concerned with others' well-being, regardless of whether they treat him well or whether they don't treat him well, whether he speaks the same language as them, whether he doesn't speak the same language as them. This child represents everything that could be in life, the potential of positivity, and that's how he's living his life in this righteous sort of way.
You ain't got to own nothing. ain't got to be a big somebody. All you got to do is believe in it, boy.
Puoi girare la tua testa così? Guarda.
God made this thing here through man's hand. But the Lord gave it shape and purpose. And through this little thing here, God gives you something else, boy. You know what it is? It's a secret. Miracles.
James, what does it mean to you to work for the screen as opposed to working for the pad and paper? But you also wrote the screenplay and then got to see it executed into the movie. So what was the difference between part A and part B?
Well, the main difference is that screenplays are all about muscle. You don't have time, really, that you'd have in a novel to go into a character's backstory or to go into their head. I mean, it's extraordinary to watch your words come to life. Omar has, at one point, one of my favorite scenes in the movie where he has almost a 10-minute scene with this Italian kid, which he basically improvised, where this whole business of using taps to communicate. And, I mean, it's a really long scene on the page. When you watch it in the movie, it was one of my favorite parts of the movie because the innocence of these two characters really mm-hmm. connects. And similarly, you know, to present Laz as Hector as an old man at the top, you put the words on the page, but when an actor takes these words and communicates them to an audience, they just take it to another level. It was quite refreshing for me. I've heard horror stories about writers whose books become screenplays, but in this case, it was really wonderful to see it happen. Spike also saw early on that this isn't really just a war movie. It's really a movie about friendship and about the commonalities that we have as people. And what he did with me was he gave me a wide palette. He gave me a wide plate and just let me exercise my ability. And as high as you can work and as hard as you can work, that's what he'll accept. When you drop below the level that you're capable of, he senses it instantly. And I suspect the actors have had that same experience.
I see a lot of head nodding, a little chuckling.
And a long distance pound at James.
Yeah. Omar, did you feel like you were ever pushed to your limits as an actor, you know, whether it was the demands of the director or, you know, the physical demands must have been considerable too.
I was pushed to the limit before we even started shooting because I had to lose 60 pounds to play the role, to play a soldier. And the movie that I shot right before, I was a burly football player. And then to play a soldier, I had to tighten up. But one of the best talents that Spike has is being able to know what everybody can do. So that when you have the role, take confidence in the fact that you are the right person for the role. And I think that, you know, we all pushed each other to take it to the next level because we're all competitive individuals. And I loved it. I work on a set like this every day of the week.
Laz, I'm going to loop back to ethnicity. Your character is Afro-Puerto Rican. You yourself are Afro-Cuban in your heritage. You're bilingual in Spanish. Your character's bilingual in Spanish. And he was kind of a bridge between these communities. Mm-hmm. So what did that bring to the table in terms of being able to play someone who was that kind of a bridge?
The main thing that helped me in portraying this character is that I'm also first-generation American, as this character was. And when you're a first-generation American, you kind of look at this country as a place of opportunity, irrespective of its faults. You know, so where I grew up with my friends kind of feeling disenfranchised in a lot of ways and left out of the American dream, mm-hmm. for me, it was still light years ahead of what would have been available to me in Cuba.
Oh,
you know, so you kind of look at things differently. And I felt like, you know, once again, James and Spike, you know, because Spike has been doing multicultural stories forever. Everybody kind of puts this big thing on, oh, it's his first war film. But this is more than just a war film. This is a story of how human beings can, in a time of crisis, can come together irrespective of language barriers, color. You know, so in essence, he was kind of the glue that kind of held this group together and, mm-hmm. and made sense of their union. And I just felt like James McBride and Spike both hit it on the head as far as showing a first-generation Latin's experience in this country, no matter how bad things may be here, to them, it's the promised land.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow.
And then add to that the symbolism of him being the radio operator, the communicator. We could go into a whole thesis. Whoa. Somebody will write a thesis on all this. James, what do you think is important to communicate about this generation of men that's dying out?
You know, we haven't gotten the chance to really thank them as a community. They were part of the greatest generation as well. Most of these men were just like the greatest generation in that they did not complain. They worked hard. And many of them, unfortunately, got to see their communities decimated by crack and drugs and so forth. And I think that was probably as heartbreaking for many of these men as it was when they came back from Europe to face the kind of discrimination they did face. I think they would be proud of what we tried to attempt here. And I think they would be delighted to know that this movie is about how they represented America in Italy. Because a soldier on the ground is really an ambassador. Mm. And the 92nd Division universally were admired and loved by the Italian people. Mm. Not because they were brave soldiers. That was only one reason. But also because they fed, they housed, they provided medical care. And a lot of these men were poor, and the Italians were poor. And they were spiritual, and they were spiritual together. They celebrated Christmas together. They sang songs together. They really related to each other. And that part of the sort of the Italian-black connection has never really been discussed in modern-day media mythology until now. And, you know, this is a blessed cast, and we've been very fortunate to tell this small story in a world of very big ones.
That was writer James McBride along with actors Derek Luke, Laz Alonso, and Omar Benson Miller. Their new movie, Miracle at St. Anna, is based on James McBride's novel by the same name. It opens nationwide today. And you can watch the full interview with the cast at our website, nprnewsandviews.org.